The title of this sermon is the Olivet Discourse. And if you want to take your Bible and follow along, the verses should already be also be in your worship guide and up on the screen. The Olivet Discourse. We're going to be in Mark chapter 13 today. And today we're going to cover an entire chapter in one sermon. Now, we don't normally do that at Church Acadiana, but we are going verse by verse through the Gospel of Mark. And this is part 44, or week 44, I should say. We've started with Mark chapter 1, verse 1, and we've just been going through the Gospel of Mark. Now we're getting close to the end. There's only 16 chapters. And we're going to cover an entire chapter this morning in one sermon. And the reason why is because this is probably the most difficult chapter in the Bible to understand and to interpret. So you came on a really interesting Sunday. We normally don't take this big of a block of Scripture and talk about it. And the passages of Scripture usually aren't this cloudy. But this is probably the most difficult passage in the Bible to understand. And so my priority this morning is to help you better understand this chapter as you're reading through your Bible. It's very, very difficult to understand. I hope to clear some of that up for you. The reason why this is called the Olivet Discourse is because for just about the entire chapter, Jesus is sitting on the Mount of Olives, and he is giving a speech or a lecture or a discourse to some of his disciples. And this passage is about eschatology. And that means the study of last things or the study of the end times. So we are talking about Bible prophecy here and end times prophecy. And that's one of the things that makes this a difficult passage to understand. Now, Matthew and Luke both wrote accounts of this Olivet Discourse, and you'll find different details in each account, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You can find the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 or in Luke chapter 21 if you want to take a look at those this week in home group as you're studying. Matthew 24 and Luke 21, you can compare and contrast and see the different details that each gospel writer adds and doesn't include. One commentator, James Edwards, writes that this chapter is one of the most perplexing chapters in the Bible to understand for readers and interpreters alike. Another commentator, Sam Storms, writes that the reason why this chapter is so difficult to understand is because most Christians think that this chapter is all about Christ's second coming. When you read this chapter, just a surface reading, it appears that Christ is talking about his return, like Jesus is coming back. Now, to be sure, Jesus is coming back. That is an orthodox Christian belief that Christians have always held since the beginning of Christianity. And he's coming back at an unknown time. We'll talk about that in just a moment. In fact, every book in the New Testament talks about the second coming of Christ, except for 3 John. So it's a prominent teaching in the Bible. But this particular chapter, believe it or not, is talking about two events. Jesus is predicting two events. He's not just talking about his return. For the bulk of the chapter, he's actually talking about something that happened 40 years after this, which was the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Most Christians don't know history. They don't read much commentary and stuff like that. And so they don't realize that most of what is talked about in this chapter has already happened, and we're not still waiting for these things to occur. We're still waiting for the second coming of Christ, but much of this chapter has already taken place, and I'll show you that this morning. Now, to give you the context of where we are, Mark chapter 13, we are in Holy Week of Jesus' life, the chronology of Jesus' life, also known as Passion Week. It's called Passion Week because passion comes from the Latin word to suffer. So when we talk about the passion of the Christ, we're not talking about what he's passionate about, even though he is passionate about dying for us and saving us. It's talking about the suffering of Christ. And as we get into Mark 13, 14, 15, we get into the betrayal, the arrest, the crucifixion, the death and burial of Jesus, his suffering, his passion. This is, according to the best estimates, Tuesday, March 31st, AD 33, Tuesday of Passion Week. Jesus is going to die on Friday. Jesus has spent much of this day on Tuesday in the temple teaching, debating. After that, they leave the temple, they leave Jerusalem, and they go up on the Mount of Olives, and Jesus is going to give this discourse, this speech. Now, to best understand this chapter, I wanted to look at it all in one sitting, in one sermon, because each section of the chapter is best understood in the context of the entire chapter, because it all goes together. It's not like Jesus said part of it this day and then part of it on another day in a different location to a different audience. He says this whole chapter to the same audience at the same time. Now, in the future, we may come back and we may take each block and go into it more in more depth. But today, this is the first time I've ever taught the Olivet Discourse. And it's probably the first time any of you have ever heard a sermon on the Olivet Discourse. So we're going to look at it all in just one big chunk. So hopefully we'll get out by one. Y'all pray for me that I can move quickly. Okay, so seven parts. Part one, if you're taking notes and want to fill in the blanks, part one, verses 1-2, Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple, and really of all of Jerusalem. Jesus predicted the destruction of the temple. Let's just go through this verse by verse. Verse 1, it says, as he was going out of the temple complex, remember on Tuesday, this is Tuesday, he had been teaching and debating. Now he's going out of the temple complex. They're leaving. One of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, look, what massive stones, what impressive buildings." Jesus said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here on another that will not be thrown down." So Jesus is making a prediction. As they were leaving the temple, one of the disciples pointed out the impressiveness of Herod's temple. This was the temple that Herod the Great, the king of Israel at the time of Christ's birth, had been renovating ever since 20 BC. And the renovation continued all the way until AD 64. So this temple was under renovation for 84 years. And it was huge. It was massive. It was 1.5 million square feet. It took up 1/6 of the city's area. It was a huge, massive, amazing temple. One of the disciples told Jesus as they're walking, "Oh, look how amazing this is, Jesus." And then Jesus says, "I assure you, it's going to be torn down. There's not going to be one stone left standing on top of another." Now, Jesus actually made three main predictions in his life. He predicted his death and resurrection three times in the Gospel of Mark. He predicted the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple right here, which was fulfilled in AD 70, just about 40 years after this. And he also predicted his second coming, his eventual return, which we're still waiting to happen. So right here, Jesus is predicting the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem. Let's talk about that just for a moment. This happened already. This was fulfilled 40 years after Jesus made this prediction. The destruction of Jerusalem is one of the most significant events in Christian history, and most Christians probably don't even know about it. In fact, I have a history book at my house written by Alton Gansky, and he writes about the 30 most significant events in Christian history, and he includes this as one of the first and one of those 30 significant events in Christian history that every Christian needs to know about, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70. The Roman Empire, the Roman army, they took control of Palestine about 63 BC, 63 years before Christ came onto the scene. And so by the time this prophecy was fulfilled in AD 70, Palestine had been under Roman rule for about 100 years. It's not that long. But ever since Rome took over, the Jews didn't like it. They did not like being ruled by a foreign power, especially a pagan foreign power, an idolatrous foreign power, an emperor who people said he was God. They didn't like it at all. And so in AD 66, the Jews began to revolt against Rome. And that's whenever the Jewish wars broke out. It started up in the north, in Galilee, where Jesus was from. That's where the rebellion started, and it slowly made its way down to the south, where Judah and Jerusalem are. And so in AD 66, the Emperor Nero, who is the Emperor of Rome at the time, a bad dude, Emperor Nero sent his army, his general Vespasian, to go and to put down the Jewish rebellion and the Jewish revolt. So according to historians, the general Vespasian, he went down to Palestine, started in the north. He took about 60,000 troops with him, and he slowly began to put down the rebellion, and he made his way down south toward Jerusalem. Now, in AD 69, so this war is taking several years. In AD 69, the Emperor Nero does Christians a favor, and he commits suicide. You know, this was a bad guy. This is a guy who, some believe, intentionally burned down the city of Rome so that he could have a new palace built and then blamed it on Christians. And so Christians were persecuted because of Nero. He commits suicide, and so the general Vespasian, who is at war with the Jews, he decides to leave and to go to Rome because he thinks, I could become emperor. And he eventually does. And he leaves his son Titus in charge to finish off the Jews. And so it's Titus who in April of AD 70 laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. Now, when an army lays siege, you've probably seen movies or read history. When an army lays siege to a city, a walled city, the goal is either to get in or to prevent anybody from getting out so that eventually the people will starve to death and all just die. So that was in April. Titus and his Roman army laid siege to Jerusalem. In August, the Romans finally made it into Jerusalem, and they ended up killing just about everybody inside. It was a huge massacre, and they ended up destroying the city and the temple. I mean, just leveling it, burning it down, destroying it to where not one stone was left standing on another. It completely destroyed Israel as a nation and Judaism as a religion, and it's never been the same ever since that time. A huge event in Christian history. Jesus said that would happen here in Mark 13. His prediction was fulfilled just about 40 years later. One of the things that reminds us of is that when Jesus says something is going to happen, it's going to happen. You can trust him. When God's word predicts something, you can bank your life on it. It's going to happen. Let's move on to part two. Part two is verses 3-4. The disciples asked Jesus about the timing of the destruction of Jerusalem and of his second coming. The disciples asked Jesus about the timing of the destruction of Jerusalem and of his second coming. So, verse 3, while he was sitting on the Mount of Olives across from the temple complex, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, tell us, when will these things happen? What are they talking about? The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. They said, when are these things going to happen? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to take place? And so they're leaving Jerusalem. Once they get to the Mount of Olives, Jesus sits down. Now, you have to let you help you understand what this looks like. Jerusalem is right here. And then here's the temple on the east side of Jerusalem, far east side of Jerusalem. And then right to the east of the temple is the Mount of Olives. And that's where they went, up on this mountain right to the east of Jerusalem. Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, facing the temple, facing the city. Now, right on the other side of the Mount of Olives, on that slope, is the city of Bethany, which is where Mary, Martha, and Lazarus lived, and where Jesus raised Lazarus from the grave, right on the other side of that mountain. So Jesus is sitting on the Mount of Olives, facing the city of Jerusalem. And the disciples, listen, they're no idiots. Jesus says that Jerusalem and the temple are about to be completely destroyed. So the disciples want to know, okay, so when's this going to happen, Jesus? And not only that, but can you give us a sign so that we can know when it's about to happen so we can get out of Dodge? Now, Mark records those two questions, but we find from Matthew's account of the Olivet Discourse that there was actually another question. In Matthew 24:3, the disciples also ask about Christ's second coming. They say, what is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? The disciples were mistaken because they thought that the end of Jerusalem was going to be the end of the world. They thought the end of Jerusalem was going to be the end of human history. That's when Jesus was going to come back and just finalize everything. They assumed those two events were going to happen together. We now know that wasn't the case. The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple happened just 40 years later in AD 70. But here we are over 2,000 years later and we're still waiting for the return of Christ. Now, this is what makes this passage so difficult to understand, is because what Jesus is going to do in verses 5-37, the rest of the chapter, is he's going to answer their question about when the destruction of Jerusalem is going to happen and when he's going to come back, the timing of his return. The hard part for us as we read this is, at what point is he talking about the timing of the destruction of Jerusalem and the events surrounding that event? And then at what point is he talking about his second coming? It's not that obvious and it's not that easy. In fact, as you read this, a surface reading, you'll probably assume that the majority of it, if not all of it, he's talking about his second coming. But I'll show you that the majority of it, he's actually talking about the events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem, which means the vast majority of this chapter is behind us. These aren't things we're still expecting to happen today. Let's go to part three. I'm going to make the point or make the case. And by the way, there is room, a lot of room, for differing interpretations on this chapter. If you and I disagree about this chapter, about when Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and when he's talking about the timing of his second coming, we're not going to kick you out of the church. There's a lot of room for disagreement. Even among the best New Testament scholars, there's a lot of disagreement on this. And so I'm going to make the case that from verses 5 through 31, Jesus is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. And then verses 32 through 37, that's when he's talking about his second coming. Let's read verse 5 and following. 5 through 13, Jesus described five events that will happen over the next 40 years before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So verses 5 through 13, we're now looking at events that Jesus said these are things that are going to happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. Let's read. It says, then Jesus began by telling them. Remember, they asked him, when's this going to happen? Jesus predicted the temple's going to be destroyed. Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. The disciples said, when is this going to happen and when are you coming back? So now Jesus is answering that. Verse 5, then Jesus began by telling them, watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name saying, I am he, and they will deceive many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, don't be alarmed. These things must take place, but the end is not yet. Now, when we see that the end is not yet, we immediately assume he must be talking about the end of the world. He's talking about the end of Jerusalem, the end of Judaism, the end of God's plan for Israel as a nation. Verse 8, for nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of birth pains. In other words, all these things are going to happen, but that doesn't mean that the end of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, is about to happen. These things are going to happen. Be ready for them. Verse 9, but you be on your guard. They will hand you over to Sanhedrins and you will be flogged in the synagogues. You will stand before governors and kings because of me as a witness to them. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all nations. That's another verse that many Christians think, well, he must be talking about his second coming because surely the good news hasn't been preached to all nations. I'm going to make the case that that verse was already fulfilled. It was fulfilled before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Verse 11, so when they arrest you and hand you over, don't worry beforehand what you will say. On the contrary, whatever is given to you in that hour, say it. For it isn't you speaking, but the Holy Spirit. Then brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rise up against parents and put them to death, and you will be hated by everyone because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be delivered. So it's important to remember the disciples' question. When is this going to happen? When is the city and the temple going to be destroyed? And what will be the sign that you're about to come back? Jesus now gives them five events that would happen over the next 40 years before the destruction of the temple. And I'm going to show you that all five of these things that he predicted in this passage have already occurred. They already occurred before that time in AD 70. The first event that he said was the appearance of false messiahs in verse 6. He says, watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name saying, I am he. Jesus was saying in the next 40 years, or he didn't say how much time it would take, but before the destruction of Jerusalem, many false messiahs will rise up. And of course, now we look back at history and we know that was the case. Josephus, the Jewish historian from the first century, wrote that during that time period, deceivers and false prophets were arrested on a daily basis. Many men claimed to be the Messiah. Also, the ancient historian Eusebius wrote about the prevalence of false messiahs during that period. So that came true. Before the destruction of the temple, many false messiahs came along and said, I'm the Messiah. Number two, the second event that Jesus predicted would happen, wars and rumors of wars. A lot of us think that this is a sign of the time. We're still waiting for this to happen to know. You know, we hear of wars and stuff around the world today. And we're like, that means Jesus is about to come back. Jesus was talking about something that would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. This already happened. And I'll show you. There were severe military conflicts during this period between the time that Jesus made this prophecy and 70 AD, both in Palestine and throughout the world. In Palestine, 20,000 Jews were killed in a conflict in Caesarea. 13,000 Jews were killed at Scythopolis. 50,000 Jews were killed in a conflict in Alexandria, Egypt. 10,000 Jews were killed in a conflict in Damascus. So Jews were being killed and slaughtered, were in conflicts all over the world during this 40-year time period. Also, the annals of Tacitus describe wars all around the world, not just in Palestine, but all around the world during that time period. He writes of disturbances in Germany, commotions in Africa, commotions in Thrace, insurrections in Gaul, the war in Britain, and the war in Armenia. So there were many wars going on at this time, just as Jesus predicted. The third event that Jesus predicted would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem were earthquakes and famines. That's another thing we see today. When an earthquake or a famine happens somewhere in the world, or a big hurricane or a tsunami, a lot of people point to it and say, see, that means Jesus is about to come back. Listen, Jesus, again, was talking about things that would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. In AD 44, there was a great famine. In fact, it's mentioned in Acts 11:28. If you remember, the church in Antioch raised a big offering for the church in Jerusalem because they were experiencing a famine, a huge food shortage. Historians record four different famines during the years of AD 41 through 54. Earthquakes were common between AD 33 and 70. Sam Storms writes, there were recorded earthquakes in Crete, Smyrna, Miletus, Chios, Samos, Apamea, Campania, and Rome. The cities of Laodicea, Hierapolis, and Colossae were devastated by a quake in AD 60. So during this 40-year time period, there was a prevalence of earthquakes and famines before AD 70, just as Jesus predicted. The fourth event that Jesus predicted would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem was persecution. Remember Jesus' words to the disciples? He said, you will be handed over to Sanhedrins and synagogues, and you'll be flogged, and children will turn against their parents, and brother against brother, and all that. So he's saying that over the next 40 years, or before the destruction of Jerusalem, there's going to be lots of persecution against Christians. And all you have to do is go read the book of Acts. And Acts tells the story of the spread of Christianity right after Jesus' ascension for those first few years. As Christianity was spreading around the world, and you can see that Christians were greatly persecuted, first by the Jews and then by Gentiles. And then finally, the fifth event that Jesus predicted would happen was the preaching of the gospel to all nations. Jesus said that the gospel would be preached to all nations before the destruction of Jerusalem, before the destruction of the temple. Now, on the surface, we say, well, that can't be right. But I want to point out to you, you have to dig a little deeper sometimes when you're studying Scripture. That word, all nations, that Jesus uses there in verse 10, is the Greek word oikoumene. Oikoumene. And when that Greek word is used, the majority of the time in the New Testament, it's not talking about every literal nation in the world, including North and South America and Australia. And it's talking about the Roman world. It's talking about the Roman Empire, every nation in the Roman Empire. Let me give you some examples. Luke 2:1, you know this verse. It says, in those days, this is a Christmas verse, in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. It's the same Greek word, oikoumene. Now, did Caesar Augustus mean for a census to be taken in the entire world literally, or the Roman world? The Roman world. Acts 11:28 says, then one of them, named Agabus, stood up and predicted by the Spirit that there would be a severe famine throughout the Roman world. That's how the Holman Christian Standard Bible translates oikoumene right there. It just says Roman world, just knowing the context, that's what it's talking about. Not the whole world literally, but or all nations literally, but the Roman world. Well, let me give you one more example. Acts 24:5. Somebody was complaining about Paul. That's the context here. For we have found this man to be a plague, an agitator among all the Jews throughout the Roman world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Again, that phrase, Roman world, is the Greek word, same Greek word that Jesus used here in Mark 13, oikoumene. And so it doesn't refer to every nation in the world, because we think today, a lot of times we think, well, we're still waiting for the gospel to penetrate every single nation before Jesus comes back. this was already fulfilled. Jesus was talking about the gospel spreading throughout the nations of the Roman Empire. That was fulfilled before 70 AD. In fact, the Apostle Paul talks about this. Colossians 1, 5 through 6, Paul says, "You have already heard about this hope in the message of the truth, the gospel that has come to you. It is bearing fruit and growing all over the world, just as it has among you since the day you heard it and recognized God's grace and the truth." Did Paul mean that the gospel was spreading to North and South America at that time? To China? He was talking about the Roman world, the same thing Jesus was talking about. Colossians 1:23, "If indeed you remain grounded and steadfast in the faith and are not shifted away from the hope of the gospel that you heard, the gospel has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven." Paul is talking about the Roman Empire. And so when Jesus says that before the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, that the gospel must be preached to all nations, he's talking about the gospel needs to spread beyond just to the Jews. Remember, the church started to the Jews in Jerusalem, to the Gentiles around the Roman world. And of course, the gospel spread throughout the Roman world and beyond by AD 70. And so I believe in verses 5 through 13, Jesus is predicting five events that would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem. And in answer to the disciples' question, when is this going to happen? And he told him all five of those things we know from history have been fulfilled. Now, part four of Mark 13, part four, verses 14 through 23. Jesus predicted one sign that will indicate the destruction of the temple is about to occur. Jesus predicted one sign that will indicate the destruction of the temple is about to occur. The disciples asked Jesus, "When is this going to happen, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem?" And then they asked him another question, "Can you give us a sign that it's about to happen so that we can be warned and get out of Dodge," right? That's what Jesus is doing here. He told them a bunch of things that would happen before the destruction of Jerusalem, but those were actually not signs of the times. Those were false signs. He was saying all these things were going to happen, but that doesn't mean the end is near. That doesn't mean the end is at hand. He was just saying these horrible things are going to happen, but the time is not yet. Now he gives them one sign to look for. Verse 14. Now again, this is something that's already happened. "When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it should not," and then Mark adds, "let the reader understand, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains." Now it's time to get out of Dodge. "A man on the housetop must not come down or go in to get anything out of his house, and a man in the field must not go back to get his clothes. Woe to pregnant women and nursing mothers in those days trying to flee Jerusalem and Judea. It's not good. Pray it won't happen in winter, for those will be days of tribulation, hardship, and suffering," and he says, "the kind that hasn't been from the beginning of the world, which God created until now and never will again. Unless the Lord limited those days, no one would survive, but he limited those days because of the elect whom he chose. Then if anyone tells you, 'Look, here is the Messiah, look there,' do not believe it, for false messiahs and false prophets will rise up and will perform signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. And you must watch. I have told you everything in advance." So now Jesus tells them one sign. He only gives them one sign to look for. He says, when this sign happens, now it's time to get out of Jerusalem, to get out of Judea, which is the province around Jerusalem, to run away. Get away as far away as you can, because it's going to get bad. That one sign, Jesus says, is called the abomination that causes desolation. Now, that word abomination is a very, very popular word in the Old Testament. It's used all throughout the Old Testament. It just means an object of disgust, hatred, something that causes revulsion, an idolatrous offense or affront to the true worship of God. What does it refer to? Jesus' disciples, to whom Jesus was speaking, would have been very familiar with that term, because the abomination that causes desolation had already happened in the past before the disciples asked Jesus this question. That phrase was used four times by the prophet Daniel to refer to an event that happened in the intertestamental period. Remember, there was a period of history between when the Old Testament was finished being written and when the New Testament started being written. There was about 400 years. That's called the intertestamental period. And during that time, Palestine was ruled by different kingdoms. At one point, it was ruled by Alexander the Great. When Alexander the Great died at age 33, his kingdom was divided into four kingdoms. And so during that period, the Syrian kingdom came to control Palestine. And there was a very wicked ruler, Syrian king, named Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a very wicked man. And in 168 B.C., this wasn't before, long before Jesus came along, so the disciples were very familiar with this event. 168 B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes, he was against religious freedom. He wanted everybody in his kingdom to be Greek and to have Greek culture, and he wanted to force it on everyone. And the Jews resisted his leadership, and so he came into Judea and Jerusalem, and he slaughtered 40,000 Jews. And he went into the temple, and he sacrificed a pig on the altar of burnt offering. Now, if you remember, as Jews, a pig is unclean. He sacrificed a pig in the altar on the altar of burnt offering. He took the broth from its flesh, and he sprinkled it all around the temple. And then he erected a statue of the Greek god Zeus on the altar. And so the Jews knew that that was the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy of the abomination that causes desolation. It's horrible. Here Jesus is. Now he's saying, guys, the sign to look for that Jerusalem is about to be destroyed is the abomination that causes desolation. Let the reader understand. In other words, he was pointing back. He was saying something is going to happen in the future that is very similar to the abomination that causes desolation that already happened with Antiochus Epiphanes. So what could Jesus be talking about? Well, when the general Titus, the Roman general Titus, finally got inside Jerusalem in August of AD 70, he finally broke in. What they did, his soldiers, they went into the temple. And remember, Gentiles can't go into the temple, not into the inner courts. They have to stay out in the outer courts, the court of Gentiles. They went into the inner part of the temple, which was an abomination in itself, and they made they offered sacrifices to the Roman emperor and to Roman gods. And that was before they slaughtered everyone and destroyed the temple. Jesus said, when that happens, when the Roman army breaks in and they go to the temple, you better get out of the city. Get out of Judea. You better run because it's about to get really bad. So the abomination of that causes desolation is something that already happened. Jesus said in verse 14, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. You better run. Verse 19 says, for those will be days of tribulation, the kind that hasn't been from the beginning of the world, which God created until now, and never will be again. Now that makes some people think that it must be something still future. Well, historians tell us that it was so bad, the Roman invasion of Jerusalem, the Romans killed 1,100,000 Jews, and they sold 100,000 into slavery. Josephus, the eyewitness to that account, wrote this. He said, the afflictions which befell the Jews were the greatest of all those, not only that have been in our times, but in a manner of those wherein cities have fought against cities, or nations against nations. It appears to me that the misfortunes of all men from the beginning of the world, if they be compared to those of the Jews, are not so considerable as they were. So an eyewitness historian said it was the worst tribulation that has ever happened to any group of people in the history of the world. So yeah, we can say with confidence that that event has already happened. Now, part five, let's move on. Now this, I want to warn you, is the most difficult part of the passage to understand. Verses 24 through 27, Jesus predicted that the gospel will continue to spread around the world after the destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus predicted that the gospel will continue to spread around the world after the destruction of Jerusalem. I'm going to make the case that these verses are not referring to the still yet to come return of Christ, but that these verses are still referring to the destruction, the judgment of God on Jerusalem. Now, when you first read them, you're going to say, what? And I'll explain it. It says in verse 24, but in those days after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not shed its light. The stars will be falling from the sky and the celestial powers will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. He will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the end of the earth to the end of the sky. I don't believe this is referring to the second coming. I think this is still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. I believe that Jesus is referring to his coming of judgment on Jerusalem, not to his second coming. And that when he says he's going to send out his angels, that word angel is a Greek word that just means messengers. And that they're going to gather his elect from the four winds. That means from all over the earth. In other words, after the destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus is going to send out his messengers, his preachers, his apostles, his prophets, all around the world to spread the gospel. And that is what has been happening since AD 70. Now Christianity, which started off with just a few people, is now the largest religion in the world, with over a billion people worshiping Christ. Now, let me give you three reasons why this is not referring to the second coming. I got to move quickly here, as if I haven't already. Three reasons why this is not referring to the second coming. First of all, in verse 24, Jesus says, now in those days. But in those days, which days has Jesus been talking about so far? The events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And Jesus says, but in those days after the tribulation. So the Roman army went into Jerusalem. They slaughtered the Jews. They went into the temple. And Jesus is saying, after that, then the ultimate judgment is going to come when Christ comes in judgment and totally levels the temple in the city, completely destroying Jerusalem and the nation of Israel. I believe that's what he's saying. So he says, in those days. The second reason I don't believe this is referring to the second coming is because a few verses after this, in verse 30, Jesus says this, I assure you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. What are all these things that he's talking about? Everything that he's already said, he says all these things, including verses 24 through 27, he says all these things will take place before this current generation who's alive right now passes away. So how could he be referring to his second coming? The third reason I believe that Jesus was referring to the events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem is because the language that Jesus used here was common language that was employed by the Old Testament prophets, not to refer to the end of the world, but to refer to judgment, to God's judgment on particular kingdoms. Let me give you some examples. In Isaiah 13, 9 through 10, Isaiah was predicting the fall, God's judgment on Babylon. And listen to the language. Now, this is something that happened already. Listen to the language that Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, uses to describe the destruction of Babylon that would come. Verse 9, he says, of Isaiah 13, he says, look, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with rage and burning anger, to make the earth a desolation and to destroy the sinners on it. Indeed, the stars of the sky and its constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark when it rises and the moon will not shine. Isaiah was using symbolic and metaphorical language not to talk about a change actually in the constellations, but a huge change that would happen among the kingdoms of the earth, changes of power. Ezekiel 32, another passage. Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel in the Old Testament, was predicting the destruction of Egypt that would come a few years after this. After this prophecy, he says, Ezekiel 32, 7 through 15, he says, when I snuff you out, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. I will darken all the shining lights in the heavens over you and will bring darkness on your land. This is the declaration of the Lord God. One commentator wrote this. He says, when Israel was judged, or when Babylon was subdued by the Medes, or when Edomia and Egypt were destroyed, it was not the literal sun, moon, and stars that were darkened. The literal stars of heaven did not fall from the skies, and the literal constellations were not dissolved or rolled up as a scroll. These figurative expressions were clearly presented in a purely symbolic manner to characterize the destruction befalling nations and earthly powers. Verse 26 of Mark 13 says, "Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory." When we read that, we think, well, he's obviously talking about his second coming. No, he's still talking about his coming in judgment. He's using very familiar Old Testament prophetic language of judgment. Isaiah 19:1 describes God's judgment on Egypt with similar words. He says this, "An oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt." Did God physically come to Egypt? No, he came in judgment. "And the idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them." And so Jesus is saying here that they will see the Lord riding on a cloud, coming in judgment. In other words, that they, specifically talking about the Jewish leaders, whenever the Roman Empire is destroying Jerusalem, especially the Jewish leaders who had rejected Christ, they will figuratively, that will be the sign for them that Jesus is indeed Lord. And it will vindicate Jesus, and they will know that Jesus is Lord and that Jesus is in power and glory. All right, let's move on. We don't have time to go into too much more depth. Oh, by the way, verse 27, as I said, it says, "He will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds." People think that's talking about the rapture, the so-called rapture. Again, I believe what this is saying is that after Jesus judges Jerusalem, comes in judgment on Jerusalem, levels the city, then he's going to send out his people, his messengers, to spread the gospel around the world and gather converts, make disciples. And I believe that's what happened, and that's what's been happening, and is still happening today, even in this very room. Part 6, we're almost done, verses 28 through 31. We already talked about this. Christ predicted that the fall of Jerusalem would occur in the lifetime of those currently living. Christ predicted that the fall of Jerusalem would occur in the lifetime of those currently living. Actually, Christ predicted that everything he's already said so far in the chapter would occur in the lifetime of that current living generation. That's why I believe that everything he's spoken about so far has already happened. It was not referring to his second coming, but his coming in judgment on Jerusalem. The key verse there, of course, verse 28, "Learn this parable from the fig tree. As soon as its branch becomes tender and sprouts leaves, you know that summer is near. In the same way, when you see these things happening, know that he is near at the door." In other words, I believe that one verse is actually talking about his second coming. It's saying, when you see all this happen, the destruction of Jerusalem and everything, know that my coming is near. And that's the way the church has lived ever since then. We don't know when Christ is coming back. And then verse 30, "I assure you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away." Part 7, finally, now we're getting to the second coming of Christ. Part 7, verses 32 through 37. "Christ commanded his followers to always be ready for his second coming because it will be unexpected." Remember, the disciples asked, "When will be the sign of the destruction of Jerusalem, and when will be the sign of your coming?" Now, I believe, is when Christ transitions and is talking about his return. Verse 32, "Now concerning that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son except the Father. Watch, be alert, for you don't know when the time is coming. It's like a man on a journey who left his house, gave authority to his slaves, gave each one his work, and commanded the doorkeeper to be alert. Therefore, be alert, since you don't know when the master of the house is coming, whether in the evening or at midnight or at the crowing of the rooster or early in the morning. Otherwise, he might come suddenly and find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to everyone, be alert." So Jesus says, now when it comes to his coming, he doesn't give us any signs. He doesn't give us any information. He just says, the time is known, unknown, be ready. The time is unknown, be ready. When it comes to the destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus said all these events that would happen before it. He even gives them a specific sign that would tell them it's about to happen. But when it comes to his second coming, he says, nobody knows, not even who? Not even the Son of God? Now that brings up a difficult question. If Jesus is God and if God is all-knowing, how did Jesus not know the timing of his second coming? I don't know. We can talk about that more in home group this week. But I do know that when Jesus came to earth, he was fully God and fully man, and he chose to willingly give up or not exercise many of his divine powers and privileges. Think about it. Jesus could have chosen not to travel in order to get from location to location. He could just blink and be there, but he traveled. How does God travel? He's everywhere. How does God become a man? He's everywhere. God did all these things. Jesus experienced fatigue, hunger. How does God experience these things? Jesus chose to give up many of his divine powers or not exercise them. And I believe for some reason, when it came to the timing of his second coming, he did not exercise his omniscient powers, his powers to be all-knowing. So Jesus didn't tell us when he's coming, but he told us to be ready. And 2 Peter 3, 10 through 12 tells us how to be ready. And we're almost done. Peter says this. Peter was one of the ones listening to Jesus on the to this Olivet discourse. Verse 10, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief. In other words, listen, we're not going to know when it's going to happen. So if you hear somebody setting dates, somebody making predictions, they're clueless. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief. On that day, the heavens will pass away with a loud noise. The elements will burn and be dissolved, and the earth and the works on it will be disclosed. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, it's talking about when Jesus comes back at his second coming, he will recreate a new heavens and a new earth. And heaven and earth will be joined, will be united, will be essentially one place. Verse 11, since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, it is clear what sort of people you should be in holy conduct and godliness as you wait for and eagerly desire the coming of the day of God. So being ready for the return of Christ means live a holy life. Have a healthy, intimate relationship with God because he could come back, y'all, today. Be ready. Always be ready. Have a good relationship with God. Live a holy life as if he may come back today. In conclusion, let me wrap this up. More like a lecture than a sermon today. In the Olivet Discourse, Jesus is not just talking about his second coming. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, an event that already happened in AD 70.